didn't need it, just wanted it. Would encourage my breakthroughs in medicine by participating as a test subject. Willing to do time. What a friend can expect from me. Getting the bill. I can't let other people pay or even split the bill because I find it so uncomfortable. Honesty. Presents from John Lewis. My last M&M. My undivided attention when I have time. A platter of antipasti upon arrival.
Jealousy is something I've had to learn a lot about when it comes to friends. As someone who is naturally enthusiastic about the good things happening in other people's lives, I find it hard to even conceive that someone could possibly be jealous of us. And if I'm quite frank, I think letting jealousy get the better of you makes you a weak person. It's not that hard to smile at someone and compliment them on something they are proud of, whether or not you consider them deserving of their good fortune. But if you think I'm about to let a few negative Nancys ruin my happiness, you're wrong. I don't do my daily gratitude lists for nothing. A good friend will share your delight about anything that you're even slightly passionate about because a good friend finds enthusiasm contagious. They care about your feelings, your life events. They want to help, to listen, to share it all with you. I don't expect perfection from a friend. No one is a mind reader or can be pleased for you 24/7. But I do expect to be treated exactly as I treat others. I wish them the best and I encourage their happiness.
Deciding to let go and draw a line under a friendship can be one of the toughest decisions to make. I wish I could say that I had a friend left from high school, but the truth is I don't. I never made strong connections there, and my memories of it aren't fond. Popularity is an ever-changing concept. Its requirements have changed so dramatically over the years, and yet some things have remained the same. Talking about your issues was never something that was widely accepted, and there was always an overbearing element of shame that surrounded open discussion. Whether it be sexual orientation or mental health, back in school I never felt able to share these things without running the risk of being labelled as different and branded unpopular. And even though it can still be incredibly difficult for kids, teenagers and even adults to open up, even in a safe, non-judgmental environment, I think there's a lot more acceptance and widespread support now than there once was. People bash the online community for its trolls and its hate speech, but from what I've seen, it's proved to be one of the most supportive communities available to us. Popularity no longer solely hinges on appearing cool with all of its superficial values. It can come from just being yourself. Many people online have been brave enough to publicly expose themselves, at the same time tapping into a lot of the insecurities that many of us struggle with and providing us with someone to relate to. They become a voice for those who don't feel they have one and offer comfort to those who seek it. If you look at most incredibly successful YouTubers, a lot of them have been and remain very vocal on issues they struggle with. Anxiety, eating disorders, gender identity or mental health, talking about these things at school wasn't even an option for me. So it's great to see this positive movement helping so many people. If there'd been a YouTuber who spoke about suffering with OCD back when I needed it, I would have watched every single one of their videos. But there's a flip side to everything, so let's get real for a second. Popularity online is also based on looks, clothes, cars, stage photographs and items of high material value. We're all guilty of editing our lives to appear more enriched, and I'm not going to sit here and pretend I'm above all that because I have a compulsion to be honest. I'm no exception. I absolutely apply filters. I absolutely try out every one before uploading to Instagram. Is it shameful to want to look your best? Well, here's the thing. There's a big difference between wanting to look your best online and editing your entire life story. Even though we all do it to a certain degree, there are friends of mine who go above and beyond. Friends from school, friends from work, other influencers, all in a constant battle for the most impressive experience, the cutest love story, the most thrilling adventure. We look at their photographs and think, damn, they're truly living their best life. Why aren't I doing that? I need to up my game. I need to get out there. Or better yet, I need to appear like I'm getting out there. It's tough not to get consumed by it and conform when everyone else seems to be. But what I've realised is that popularity has nothing to do with true friendship. Yes, it's nice to feel liked, to feel popular, and it's also nice to appear like you're having a fantastic life. But friendship should never be based on how successful you are, or how pretty, how wealthy, or how adventurous you seem. The friendships that last are the friendships based on your truth. You should never feel obligated to lie or exaggerate to appeal to someone. If that's what impresses them the most, rather than the intrinsic person you are, then perhaps they're not the right friends for you. I realize it's very easy to tell you to try not to worry about the way you come across online, in a world where our online profile is fast becoming the first thing other people are introduced to. But keep in mind that you're more than your bio and your profile picture, and so are other people. Although I'm certainly one to apply a filter, one thing I've never done is misled my audience into thinking I'm happier, more wild, or more in love than I am in real life. I treat Instagram like my own photo journal to document the places I've been and the happy occasions in my life. With the exception of the occasional ad, all of the photographs I upload would be the same even if no one was following me. Try to remain as true to yourself as possible. Then you remove the pressure to be anything other than yourself.
How could I talk about friendship without mentioning Facebook, the very founder of the term friend request? I find Facebook and the different ways people use it totally fascinating. The bragging, the ranting statuses. I don't know what I loathe the most. Actually, I do. It's the humble brag. Now, as a young person working in social media, I understand that the very essence of social media is self-indulgence. Everyone wants to portray their best side to the world online, and of course, there's nothing wrong with that. If I have the choice of a photo taken from a bad angle or one with a flattering pose and a sexy filter, I know which one I choose for my profile pic. But I am judging the social media braggers. Here are a few classic examples of social media bragging that I love to hate. People who check into first-class lounges on Facebook. Even worse, the people who pretend to be taking a casual selfie, but position something within shot in a totally orchestrated pose that clearly took 55 tries to get right, that makes it obvious they're in first class. People who talk about how busy they are in a failed attempt to act overwhelmed when they are really just trying to show off their high-profile, jam-packed itinerary and rubbing your full-time, no-holiday-days-left nose in it. Mothers who use their baby to create a baby flat lay, much like bloggers do with their breakfast in a hotel room post. No one cares how old your baby is this week. People who upload every single photo they took on their 3-month-long trip to Bali. I don't need to see 550 photos of you in the same outfit next to the same elephant. I don't care. And finally, the cherry on this overinflated cake is the multi-item money shot. This is when a person has a lot of money and has spent it on many high-priced material possessions. They want to show off said possessions but don't know where to begin. Or perhaps they do want everything in one shot to make the most impact. Either way, the result is this: the most uncomfortable stage photo, that typically consists of a Mercedes, a coffee cup clasped in a manicured hand with an expensive engagement or wedding ring, a swanky watch, and a fixed smile revealing whitened pegs. This one is honestly my favourite, especially the version where someone else has had to take the photo in order to capture both jewellery-laden hands clasping the steering wheel. The length some people will go to online to flaunt money is priceless. So guys, why do some people do this? Why all the passive aggression and self-importance? When did Facebook turn into such a competition? I'm guessing the cutthroat gloating began shortly after people woke up to social media's dark side, as a mechanism to stalk old flames and former friends. We've all been there, and sometimes we get caught doing it, but that still doesn't stop us. Once, while checking out my ex-boyfriend's Instagram page, my greasy digits slipped clumsily and I accidentally liked one of his photos. Even worse, I didn't realise, so the photo remained liked. I went off to work, and then my ex screenshotted my like and uploaded my horrific mistake to his Instagram. He smugly and publicly called me out on my humiliatingly blatant investigation, and it was broadcast on his page for the world to see. But why was I getting all private detective on my ex in the first place? I know why. I wanted to know what he was up to, and perhaps I wanted to see if I was doing better than him. Please don't judge me, because I'm sure you can all relate to my honesty. Who doesn't want to have the upper hand, especially over someone who spectacularly dumped you? I suppose this admittedly narcissistic viewpoint is the exact reason why some people show off on social media. While we're being so decent and honest, who hasn't checked up on some people from their past or even their present? The only way I'm still connected to most of my school friends is through Facebook, and there is something addictively compelling about observing a bunch of people who grew up together and then all went their separate ways to live totally different lives. Here are a few cliched but totally honest observations from a quick perusal of old school peers on my personal Facebook. Lots of people have babies now. That's it. Does it make me feel good to check up on people? Not really. It's not something I do often, but I'd be lying if I said I'd never done it. Do I revel in glee when I see someone has drawn the short straw in life? Absolutely not. We've all been through our low points, and social media has almost certainly documented them. What about when someone is doing well? Then I'm genuinely happy for them. Which I suppose makes the whole concept of checking up on people rather redundant, if you're only going to empathize with their unhappiness or congratulate their success. I suppose the moral of the story would be, don't do it. Don't Facebook stalk your past or present peers, exes, work colleagues, or friends of friends. Just don't. But here's a delightful concept that I hope will make me appear wise rather than old and past it. There is more to life than how well you are doing in comparison to everyone else. There is more to life than how many likes you get on a post or status. You are more than your social media profiles. Ask yourself this. How many people on your Facebook would you actually call a friend? Now ask yourself this. Who cares? Is anyone really looking at you that closely? And if they are, perhaps they should be focusing more on their own habits.
One of my biggest motivations was wanting to do better than the losers in school who looked down on me because I didn't think drugs were cool. I mean, what wasn't cool about numbing their crippling insecurity while dressed as something from a Matrix fan convention? And as sad as it is, nothing is more satisfying than seeing what they're up to now when they try to add me as a friend on Facebook. You didn't speak to me in school. I've had no contact with you since then. But 14 years later, you decide now is the time to reach out? Well, guess what? I'm not a National Trust exhibit you assume you can reach out to. So what do I do when this happens? I accept their friend request. You might be thinking, hold up, you've lost me. But let me explain the sheer deliciousness. I accept their friend request for 24 hours to allow them enough time to peruse my photographs, see the places I've been to, and the achievements Rosie and I have accomplished together. So they know that their rebuffing of my high school social advances has had no effect on my life. I let that sink in overnight while I scroll through their colourful employment history. Now, I'm not a job snob. How could I be when most people assume I'm lucky to have the job I do? But when I see unsavoury high school characters from the past trying to dress up their job title for the sake of social media, my mouth waters. That's my drug. How ironic that the high I get is from seeing how they've never evolved or amounted to anything. What poetry! After a 24-hour window of analysis, I delete them. It's what I like to call the old add and destroy. Let them experience the dopamine surge of an accepted request, only to deprive them of it later. That is so messed up, I can't even believe I just wrote it. I can't believe how genius it is. Don't get me wrong, I'm not really full of bitterness and resentment, because I don't think negative emotions can ever be the sole driving force propelling you to achieve something positive. They can act as a springboard, but you have to take yourself the whole way because you want it for you. Just thought I'd add that bullshit sentence to appear enlightened. Nailed it! I always thought adult friendships would work differently to childhood ones. And although they're far more passive-aggressive in terms of bragging or fighting without actually arguing, the emotional neediness is exactly the same. We just display it differently. We think we're cleverer than we were as children, masking our emotions, appearing unbothered, or communicating with passive aggression rather than honesty. But not everyone is like this. Rosie is so pure that she's totally unable to adopt the characteristics of the city serpent. Serpentine behaviour predominantly manifests in a form of communication that stems from both an attacking and a defensive position. I call it serpenting. Serpents strive to catch you out, whether that's in a lie, by manipulating, or simply in an attempt to defend themselves. I'm extremely good at serpenting because it's the way my family communicates. I was raised in a nest. Laura, my mother and I would argue through tactical passive-aggressive strikes, and even though we all knew we were arguing, we never admitted to it. That was conceding, and it meant you were out of the game. It was a battle of who could strategically corner the other person first, a war of words, like lawyers desperate to keep a cool head, but salivating at the thought of their next blow. Serpenting is like an ice-cold bitch slap that's intended to highlight the weaknesses in your argument. It's the way we communicate in business, where the art is to win without appearing emotional. What's ironic is that there's actually nothing clever or adult about arguing in fluent serpent with your friends or family. When two people are stripped back, have an honest conversation, and just say what's upsetting them, things are quickly resolved and everyone can move forward without the laborious game playing. But that's not as fun, is it? And certainly not in my nature. Why be honest when you can dance around your point for hours? It's like Monopoly. Why go for Park Lane when you could dominate the entire street leading up to it? Nothing beats the satisfaction of knowing you've won before actually winning. I'll never forget my first lesson in Serpent Key Stage 1. My mum picked me up from primary school, and as we were walking back to where she'd parked, my friend William zipped past in the new family car he'd spent all day bragging about. He was sitting in the back seat as his mother revved the N-reg so we'd all turn to look. As I did so, William threw me a smug glance and a facetiously slow wave. My face turned to thunder. I looked at the ground and didn't respond. My mum immediately picked up on it and asked what was wrong. I told her Will had spent the whole day bragging about his mother's new car and how she'd be picking him up in it later. Now came the lesson. Mum told me I should have waved back, smiled, looked completely unaffected and happy for him and his mother's new purchase. I didn't get it. She told me that depriving him of the satisfaction of making me jealous would have made his entire day showing off a waste, resulting in resentment. A waste of William's time and a huge win for me. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. Depriving people of their desired reaction became my hobby. I was really put through my paces in secondary school when a friend of mine seemed to take sadistic delight in serpenting me with the desire of making me worry about things. Whether it was fake homework she said was due, or tests she said were that day, my remaining unresponsive, unflapped and altogether unaffected frustrated her to no end. She'd try every angle to passive-aggressively argue with me. It's like she just wanted my attention any way she could get it. Her venomous blows struck me from every angle. Some people take delight in abusing the ways of my people to cause harm and distress. This is insulting to my heritage. We use our powers when we must, like getting to the bottom of a diary confession, not simply to inflict harm because we can. With great power comes great responsibility. And serpenting should only ever be used when absolutely necessary and never without provocation. This has been difficult for me to stick to, even in my romantic relationships. My ex-partner was so unbelievably manipulative that serpenting was the only way we communicated. All of her compliments were propelled by a shady backwards intention, something put in place to knock my confidence, rather than to build it up. I'd become so used to reading in between the lines that when I met Rosie, I wasn't sure what were games and what was real. What's so refreshing about Rosie is that what you see really is what you get. She's so honest about how she feels, and if she ever thinks I'm serpenting, she'll say,
"Okay, what's going on here? Let's just have an honest conversation, no walls."
And then I resentfully back down to a place of vulnerability. I hate that place.
The worst types of people. Here's a generic and offensive list of some of the worst types of people. People with weak handshakes. At what point in life did we forget the importance of a good handshake? There is nothing I hate more than a flaccid wrist and a distinct lack of grip when I'm meeting someone new. This can only be an indication of the slippery, non-committal nature. Anyone who calls themselves an entrepreneur when actually they're just self-employed. People who take photographs of themselves as if they aren't aware of the camera. What the fuck? You took the picture. People who take pictures of themselves pretending to be asleep. You're not asleep. You took the picture. People who stop the cheers for the champagne shot. The occasion is champagne. Just let me drink it. People who live to be constantly outraged. Get over your perpetual state of offense.
And now here's a list of the best types of people. People eager to throw you an emergency laugh. People who don't make judgments. People who carry a spork. People who remember the things that are important to you. People who tell you if there's a small tree stuck in your teeth. People willing to indulge in your dreams. People willing to practice kissing cruel intention style. Let me tell you something about manners. They cost nothing, but they're worth a lot. That was one saying that was drilled into us at primary school. That, and don't wipe your nose with your sleeve. Rosie obviously went to a different school. There's nothing I detest more than an arrogant, conceited twat who deems their self-worth so highly they don't consider manners to be important. I hate seeing how success, fame, and money can change people. Being grounded, staying in touch with your audience, and not being divorced from reality are the most important things any star can do. And in my opinion, they're the key components of a long and successful career. As soon as you start believing you're better than your viewers, your friends, or even your family, you've lost it. You've become an entitled ass oozing cringe from every enlarged orifice. You ooze a similar brand of embarrassment as child stars who think they've hit the big time, but at least they don't know any better. It's even worse when it's YouTubers. YouTube is a platform allowing anybody to upload their original content. If you're fortunate enough to become popular, your audience is absolutely everything. Unlike other careers in the entertainment industry, being a YouTuber is all about the relationship you have with people watching your videos. You're backed solely by them, and every opportunity that comes to you is because they have put you on the map. To ever assume you've reached the point when you can forget your fans or take them for granted is the point when you've lost touch. Losing touch makes you completely unrelatable, unlikable, and no longer accessible. And being inaccessible to your audience means there's a distinction between you and them, which isn't what YouTube is about for me. I understand that for YouTubers with subscribers in the millions, that the dynamic might change. You might not be able to walk out as easily in public, and you have to be smart about how much personal information you're willing to share for your own safety. But if you start to believe that you're popular because you're better, that your time is more precious because you're a business mogul and not one of us, that you can start refusing people selfies because they don't directly contribute to your channel growth, then what are you really in it for? I don't consider myself famous, but YouTube stars constitute a new brand of celebrity which isn't fully understood yet by mainstream media. And as much as I sit here and criticize those who have seemingly lost touch, I have experienced what it's like when subscribers overstep boundaries, which I'm sure is only magnified when your subscribers are in the multi-millions. That's one of the difficulties in maintaining a strong relationship with your viewers without sacrificing your own privacy. Fortunately, the majority of our online fans are incredibly respectful, not only to us, but to each other. And we're very lucky to have garnered the considerate audience that we have. I've only ever met a handful who have tried to steal my hair for a potion, and even then I've respected their commitment. No matter who you are, what you do, or what circles you move in, remaining courteous, respectful, and grounded will strengthen every relationship that you have and will encourage the right ones.
Why don't we set some social media ground rules, seeing as we are all guilty of the same online faux pas? Next time social media ever makes you feel less than, you can recap on these rules and chill. Social media ground rules. Stop comparing yourself to people on Instagram and social media in general. We all know the same tricks. We all do them. Social media is full of people posing awkwardly to make their bodies appear more toned and slender. Airbrushing wrinkles, spots, scars and marks. People with thick makeup on who look exactly the same as you or me when they are makeup free. Imagine me in this situation. I'm sat here writing this book with about 20 layers of prescription moisturizer on my winter chapped skin. I look greasy. I can feel a large boil forming on my right cheek. My hair is scraped back and I'm wearing joggers. I don't know how some people look amazing in joggers on Insta, while I always look like a boiled egg drowning in dog head fabric. There are gaps in my eyebrows. My cave smells like old tea. But that's okay. It's okay for these people to want to look obnoxiously attractive on Instagram. And it's okay that nobody looks like that 24/7. You are no less than these people. Everybody is worth the same. Everybody is trying their best. Everybody feels and looks like shit some of the time. That's okay. You can stop comparing. Stop bragging and stop checking up on people and wondering if they've seen your latest post. It doesn't matter how well anyone else is doing. The only person you should compete with is your former self. That way you can constantly improve and become a better person. Everybody is in a different life situation, so comparison is futile. Remember that people probably aren't having as much fun as you think they are. Or if they are, that's okay too. Don't feel down if someone seems to have more money, more trips to exotic places, more friends or more likes. Everybody in the world goes through ups and downs. Your life will get better, and these people will go through some lows and some more highs. Be kind always. Everybody is fighting an invisible battle no one else knows about. Be careful with your words. Think before you tweet. And finally, be positive whenever possible. This is probably the best rule ever. Positivity is contagious. I think we can all agree that you'd much rather scroll through your timeline and see something positive than some horrendous piece of news or soul-destroying story. I don't want to unexpectedly read something that brings down my mood for the rest of the day. It's not physically possible to be spreading happiness 24/7, but if you spread the love as much as possible, I don't see how that could ever be a bad thing. Talking about comparing yourself to the goddesses of Instagram brings us to FOMO, fear of missing out. I suffer from this occasionally, as I can't stand the thought of other people having a better time than me. It's typical human nature to want what we can't have, which is why everyone else's Nando's always looks better than yours. Oh, why didn't I order that? You sigh inwardly. It's exactly the same in social situations. When you're at home with your feet up and crumbs around your mouth, you may regret not accepting the invitation to that thing. Worse still, you may lament the complete lack of invitation at all. But I bet you've all been on a night out and let your eyes glaze over, imagining all the things you'll do when you get home. Take off your binding clothes. Eat that leftover pasta. Put the heating on and watch Gilmore Girls, waiting for Rory and Lorelai to finally kiss. The list of fun stuff you could do at home suddenly becomes endless when you're not there. In fact, Rose has taken the time to diligently make a list of things that are all worth staying in for.
A packet of jelly beans. Mixing two types of cereal. Purposely sending voice notes to the wrong friends pretending you're bitching about them.
Lol!
Seeing if a radiator toasts a marshmallow.
Thanks for that, Rose. Social anxiety. We can't discuss our social lives, or lack thereof, without mentioning social anxiety. For me, this was something that didn't exist in my world until one day it arrived, bringing along with it a suitcase, a toothbrush, and a stubborn refusal to leave. Social anxiety affects me even at the mere thought of being social, which is a paradox because I like to think of myself as a confident and friendly, outgoing person. I like people. I love hearing about people's lives, their jobs, what they get up to. I also like talking to people, but I worry. I worry so much. I worry that what I just said wasn't funny. I worry that everyone thinks I'm weird. I worry that everyone secretly hates me or, at the very least, finds me annoying. I worry that my outfit is wrong for the occasion, that I stand out. I worry that people have noticed my insecurities and are judging me for them. In fact, here's a list of things I worry about on a regular basis. People silently judging the way I eat. That there is something on my face or in my teeth that shouldn't be there. Seeing someone clock a spot on my face and watching their eyes flip between the spot and my gaze. Breaking wind in an enclosed area, for example, in a car or in a room with just one other person. Everyone falling silent and the mental frenzy that comes with finding something to talk about. Ass paranoia. This wasn't always something I worried about, until an incident when I arrived at the train station ready for a night out, while unknowingly flapping around a meter of loo roll that was protruding from my bottom. So how do you overcome social anxiety when you desperately want to be social, or at the very least, want to feel comfortable and at ease? Well, I've written a few tips that might help you. For starters, remember that everyone has felt awkward, shy, and anxious at some point, so you aren't alone. People have been through this before and got through it. You can do this. Number one, prepare. I know myself and my body extremely well, and I have been pretty public when it comes to discussing my bodily habits. When I'm anxious, I know that I will inevitably be rushing to the bathroom. Before I do live events, radio shows, or anything that I feel is important or where people will be listening closely, I get diarrhea. This book isn't called Overshare for no reason. For events that aren't quite as important but still get my adrenaline pumping, my body responds by forcing me to empty my bladder multiple times. Knowing this is how I react helps me prepare. I always carry Imodium in my bag, and I go to the loo as much as possible, and I occasionally limit my water intake. If you know your body reacts to stressful situations by having stomach cramps, bring painkillers. If you stress sweat, carry a small stick of deodorant and wear loose clothes. If you prepare for the worst, it can reassure you that you'll cope in any anxiety-inducing situation. Number 2. Try to get out of your own head. We are all guilty of overthinking. But there comes a point when you have to stop fretting over every possible eventuality and just go for it, which leads me to my next point. Number 3. Face your fear. I've done this countless times, and let me tell you, it is so rewarding. If you thought I wasn't afraid of standing on stage in front of thousands of people, you were wrong. On stage, I felt totally naked. There is nowhere to hide. But the feeling that hits me when I finish a show is overwhelmingly positive. If you push yourself to go to something you were worried about and end up having a fantastic time, it will make you more inclined to go again the next time. Give it a chance. Number 4. People are kinder than you think. You worry that all eyes are on you, judging you. But are you judging other people? Picking them apart, internally criticizing them? I know I'm not. I try my hardest to smile at people and make friends. Chances are, the people you are surrounded by might have the exact same worries and nerves that you have. They might be feeling even worse. Give people a chance. You never know where it might lead. Number 5. And finally, smile. Sometimes you just have to fake it till you make it. Wear a big smile and you will look approachable. Also, it's hard to feel too bad when you're smiling. Take a deep breath, hold your head up, smile, and give them all you've got. Sometimes, doing our best is the best we can do.
Over the last few years, Rosie and I have met a lot of people from different industries, and we've made some excellent friends. We like to be close to the people we work with, because gelling as a unit makes life so much easier, especially if we're touring the world. We make sure to surround ourselves with the best team, so that whatever we're working on results in the best possible outcome. Having creative goals in common and feeling excited about the content we're creating is something that has brought us together with people who are now some of our closest friends and colleagues. It proves that even as we grow older, new people will come into our lives and that there's always space for new friendships. So give people a chance, but know your limits and never expect perfection. No one is perfect, so don't let what could be a potentially amazing friendship slip away. Don't give up on people. Not everyone is shit, only the majority. Sometimes you will have to walk away from people, and uncomfortable situations like that keep Rosie awake at night. Well, not really, that girl sleeps like a narcoleptic sperm whale, but it definitely makes her anxious. But I've come to realise that friends come and go, and that life is like a bus journey. As you're driving along, some people will get on, and some will get off. Some will stick with you until your final destination, and others will skedaddle at the end of the mixtape. Some people might get off, only to get on again a few stops later. You might even find yourself throwing people off the bus and underneath it, and that's okay. Just don't drop below 50 miles per hour, because you never know if Dennis Hopper has alternative plans for you.
Boundaries are something I'm still trying to figure out, although Rose and I have had a safe word since the very beginning of our relationship. It's important to know where to draw the line with some people. Following suit of Dua Lipa, I've written down some rules, or guidelines really, that you might find helpful when it comes to knowing your limits. It's okay to want space from people. No one should make you feel guilty for needing some time alone or away. I've learned that the best friends are the ones you can pick up the phone and call and nothing has changed, no matter how many weeks, months, or years have flown by. It's okay not to have friends for a while. If the friends you do have are making you feel drained and lacking in confidence, you should feel fine about letting go and giving yourself some time on your own. I think it's brave to make the decision to have no friends rather than the wrong ones. You need to surround yourself with positive people. Everyone gets dropped. It's not you. Well, it might be, but that's not very uplifting. Listen, we've all been unexpectedly dropped by friends at some point, and it's easy to take it personally. But as long as you try your hardest to treat people with kindness, sometimes you've just got to accept that not everything works out. Maybe you made a mistake that you can learn from, but maybe it just wasn't meant to be. You can't always get closure after a relationship ends, so move on. Don't ruminate, let it go. When you stop holding on to the past, you make room for the future and for the amazing new people to enter your life. No friend is perfect, so don't expect them to be. They will annoy you at times, and you will annoy them. A friendship is compromise, so accept people's flaws. Be yourself. If you like something, talk about it. No one else in the world can be you. Everybody is unique, so celebrate yourself. Chapter 6. Girl Power. You are stronger than you think you are, always. Girl power. Something I learned about extensively from the Spice Girls, and something I am truly passionate about. I hate injustice, I hate sexism, but more than anything, I hate that Jerry left. I never used to be that into politics, but there have always been causes I've been passionate about. Many years of watching Disney's Pocahontas has conditioned me into having a deep and profound respect for the environment, and if something that could have been recycled gets put into the wrong bin, I feel tremendously guilty. Naturally, marrying a woman, being bisexual, and garnering a predominantly LGBT audience has flung me even deeper into politics than I could have ever imagined. We don't live in a world where all the rules are the same, and we don't live in a world where everyone is treated equally. As well as wanting equal treatment for the LGBTQ+ community, I want equal treatment for people of all races, ethnicities, and genders. I wish for the equality of all humans. Like everyone, I get upset about the injustices in the world. Sometimes it can get on top of you. You can think, I am just one person. How can one person fight such powerful forces? It's easy to feel overwhelmed. But each day, I'm reminded that Rose and I have a platform and an audience, and we have a voice. I've already discussed how Rose and I began our journey feeling underqualified to speak out on behalf of the LGBTQ+ community. But we slowly found our voices when we saw that we could make a difference. Suddenly, we realized that it wasn't just about the LGBTQ+ community anymore, but about everyone. We could help people by discussing Rose's OCD, by discussing anxiety, relationships, or even simply by listening to our audience and letting them choose topics for us to discuss. Change can start in small ways, and instead of feeling like perhaps I wasn't qualified to discuss these topics, I realized that, actually, it was my born right, regardless of our YouTube platform. I'm a person who lives on this earth too. My experiences and my feelings count. I'm allowed to speak up and say my piece. I hoped I could educate people online, but at the same time, I was also learning a lot. Although global politics is arguably more turbulent now than ever before, I couldn't help but notice the incredibly powerful movements that are happening. For example, the Black Lives Matter marches and hashtag on Twitter. Growing up in an extremely small town, I'd never been awakened to just how oppressed some people are in the world. But through the power of the internet and ordinary people sharing posts on Facebook and retweeting videos on Twitter, messages get spread and, more importantly, messages get heard. I can remember seeing an extremely shocking video about a nurse who refused to give a patient's blood work to a police officer who did not possess the required warrant. This woman was verbally abused by the officer and was later arrested. Watching the video left me seething at the injustice. But because it was filmed, uploaded, and spread via the internet, it could no longer be ignored, and the police officer in question lost his job. Justice was served. Another powerful message being spread via the internet is the Me Too movement. The movement was actually started in 2006 by Tarana Burke, and originated when she listened to a young girl's story of abuse. At the time, Tarana wanted to tell the girl, Me Too, but couldn't. But the idea was born. Hashtag MeToo has since become a viral rallying cry and an attempt to demonstrate the magnitude of people, both men and women, who have suffered from rape and sexual abuse. I have personally seen waves being made, have witnessed, almost solely through the power of the internet, people becoming more aware and more educated on subjects such as equality, victim blaming, slut shaming, cultural appropriation, racism, feminism, and many more powerful subjects that need discussing. My eyes were being opened. I used to be someone who didn't vote. I didn't understand politics. I thought it was simply too great a subject for me to tackle. But I registered, I researched, and I voted, and I encouraged others to do the same. Perhaps controversially, I honestly didn't care who other people voted for. I just wanted them to vote. I have learned to respect everybody's opinions, even if they don't align with my own. I found that kindness and compassion is the best way to reach someone, although I'll admit it took me a while to learn that. As you start to dip your toes, or even wade, into the thick, messy waters of politics, it can be easy to get swept away. The more I understood, the less I could accept that that's how things were. Gun control, the mistreatment of innocent animals, the imbalance of the justice system, the fear-mongering of the tabloids, racism, prejudice. I became overwhelmed and had to take a step back for a while. I wanted to be an activist, to help people, but for my own sanity, I realized that sometimes it's okay to take a break from these things. But that's the thing with change. The world keeps turning, things keep happening, and you have to stay positive. You have to fight, and most importantly, you have to keep going. So let's get on to the issues that need tackling, starting with sexism.
I hate sexism. I hate it more than other people's spit landing on my lip and having to pretend like I didn't notice. I'm confident when I say most women have experienced sexism at some point in their lives. Coming from men, it doesn't much surprise me. Though obviously, it's uneducated and beyond moronic. But when it comes from women, that I can't fathom. When I used to advise people on Apple hardware back in my days of retail, there were countless times I'd be overlooked as customers beelined for my male colleagues. Older men were the worst offenders, but several older women spurned my offer to help because they assumed I didn't know as much as the male staff. Technology? Women? How could those two things possibly go together? My tiny female mind could never have the intellectual capacity of a man's. I could never be expected to retain knowledge like a man could, nor could I truly understand the information I had managed to cram into my hopelessly underdeveloped girl brain. Ridiculous. Nope, they'd rather save their time and talk to someone reliable with a penis credential. Due to the nature of my job, gender stereotyping was something I constantly had to battle, and most days I enjoy the challenge. While working at the store, I distinctly remember approaching an elderly female customer to ask if she needed any assistance. Now, this lady wasn't frail. She was in sound mind, and one would hate to assume, considering the topic we're discussing, but I imagine she only needed her iPad for Candy Crush Jelly Saga and games to enhance her memory. But hey, she might have been writing a novel, dialing into video conferences, or hacking security systems. Just because she was older didn't mean she was useless. That's ageism, and it's something I'm sure I'll experience now I'm 30. As the words, "Is there anything I can help you with?" passed my lips, the lady looked at me, visibly humoured by my offer, drew the cover over her iPad screen and said, "I think it's best I speak to one of those men." I replied with, "Well, what's the issue? Perhaps it's something I can help with." I was concerned she'd noticed the blood dripping onto my T-shirt from where I'd bitten through my tongue, but I needn't have worried. She was already gone. Ironically, she'd approached the most inept member of staff in the history of retail and human development, so I thought that was punishment enough for her sexist thinking. With a mentality like that, I wanted to ask her why she assumed her woman-shaped mind would be able to grasp my male colleague's explanation. I mean, if I wasn't able to grasp technology as a woman, why would she? Defying people's crude assumptions by having the knowledge they needed to overcome their technical issues was extremely rewarding, delicious even. But it wasn't just the customers I had to contend with. Even my bosses treated me differently when push came to shove. I worked with three men. There were four full-timers, myself included, and our job was to sell Apple hardware and teach customers how to use it. The boys never wanted to do the one-to-one tutorials because it required patience and, frankly, they couldn't be bothered. The shop was quiet most days, and between drinking coffee and the routine sexism, I'd often find myself enveloped in bubble wrap, seeing how long I could stand on one leg before falling over. But one thing was for sure. When it was time to work, I was there and I was present. I took huge satisfaction in being the best, selling the most and being helpful, friendly and competent. It was the first job I'd had since graduating university, and it was one that I took pride in. I knew my abilities and my strengths, and I knew when to ask for help if I needed it. I soon became the face of the Your Time sessions, as they were known, and always craved more responsibility. And yet, at a staff meeting one morning, I experienced behaviour that was so shocking, it led to my decision to walk out. A friend of the store owner had popped into the shop and relayed information about his customer experience. His feedback included members of staff failing to approach customers and instead standing idle on their phones on the shop floor. Well, I knew that wasn't me. The bubble wrap restricted arm movement, so I certainly wouldn't have been able to hold a phone. In all seriousness, I was always first to greet a customer and offer my help. Our manager had clearly got a bollocking from his off-site superior and had decided it was time to point fingers. In our staff meeting, he was visibly angry about the feedback. But instead of talking to us as a team, he found it far easier to focus his eyes on me. He was extremely pally with his male co-workers, as he'd worked alongside them for years before I joined the company. It was clear that he felt uncomfortable reprimanding them, so decided to center his attention exclusively on me. "We can't just play on our phones all day and ignore customers. It's not good enough. I'm sick of people standing behind the computer all day browsing the internet. Customers are our top priority." I agreed with everything he was saying, but why was he only looking at me? I didn't take cigarette breaks, I didn't avoid engaging with customers, but I was being made to accept full responsibility because I was an easy target. I was the youngest, I was a woman, and I wasn't his mate. His unmerited targeting became so obvious that I felt embarrassed on his behalf and my colleagues were noticeably uncomfortable. He was too cowardly to speak to us about it collectively in case he damaged the relationship he had with his friends, and I was forced to take accountability for everyone because I was a woman. No doubt about it. Well, I wasn't going to accept that. "Why are you only looking at me?" I asked. I hadn't been singled out by the secret shopper, so what evidence was there that I was exclusively at fault? I was so confident in my performance that I doubted the blame lay with me. My boss didn't have a lot to say when I questioned his conduct. I'd had enough. I grabbed my jacket, nailed my pissed-off-with-purpose exit walk, and left. It was the most pathetic male performance I'd ever witnessed, and as I walked through town, I realized that I'd sacrificed my job for the greater good of womankind. I felt accomplished. I felt independent. I felt financially vulnerable. I mean brave.
Now, you might think we're coming across as brash and whiny, and trust me, I get it. Rose can be particularly shrill when she's upset, like most women get when they're hysterical. Lol. And I understand that there are bigger problems in the world, and that there are still people who are starving, who are homeless, who are sick and can't afford healthcare. I know we should be strong, and we shouldn't sweat the small stuff. But for me, being strong means not standing for even the smallest amounts of gender stereotyping and never allowing a man to talk down to me because he is older or simply because he's a man. Let's talk about Julia Roberts in Pretty Woman a moment. Several years ago, Rose and I opened our first merch store, which we completely ran and organized ourselves. Before the store went live, we looked into options of how best to deliver merchandise to our customers around the world. We had a pretty accurate projection of how much we would sell, and our focus was how to get our products out as quickly as possible to everyone who had ordered them. Luckily, there was a global courier service just a few doors down from where we were living. Problem solved. So, Rose and I popped in, approached the man working there, and inquired about prices, postage, the works. This guy did not want us to use his postal service. He repeatedly talked down to us, saying we had to have lots of orders to qualify for the service. After questioning how many orders we'd need to qualify, we received a hesitant and seemingly speculative answer of 100 orders. "That's fine," we said, and then he endeavoured to find out whether we were selling makeup, makeup brushes, or old clothes we wanted to get rid of. We told him we were running a clothing store, and he resentfully mumbled something about fashion. This man wasn't going to move an inch. He offered every excuse in the book not to serve us, as he didn't believe we'd be successful enough to waste his time on. So, being the grudge holders that we are, and totally unwilling to let anything go, we opened our merch store using a different courier service, and later went back to pay the man a visit. We told him we'd open the store, and he grinned and said, "Did you get many orders?" "Yes," we replied. "We got 2,200 orders in our first week, and we're here to buy some printer ink for our order forms." He then had the audacity to backtrack in an attempt to claw back our custom. Never. He didn't believe we'd do well. He didn't believe we knew what we were talking about. He thought we were overestimating our sales predictions and that there'd be little demand for our makeup brushes. He assumed we were selling makeup because we were women. But even if we were, what difference does that make in terms of our need for his service? I have no time for people who don't believe women can be successful just because they are women.
Rosie, you're getting really worked up. Maybe it's your period.
It's bizarre how some men decide to have arguments with women just because they're women. I've been in countless situations where I've been spoken to like I was lesser, like I was stupid, or I've been belittled by someone abusing their position of power. I walk away thinking, there's no way he would have engaged in a confrontation like that if I'd been a man. I distinctly remember losing my train ticket once, leaving me with nothing to present at the barrier of my destination. As annoying as it was, I was fully willing to pay whatever fee I'd incurred by travelling without a ticket. When Rosie and I approached the man working at the station, I began to explain my dilemma. He didn't even pretend to listen to me. Before I could even finish my sentence, he said it was an offence to travel without a valid ticket. If he'd have let me finish, he'd have understood that I agreed with him and was willing to pay the fine. But of course, he didn't let me finish. He barely let me begin. Before I could even ask how much I owed, he said, "That's an immediate fine for travelling without a ticket." As I was asking how much that would be, he yelled, "Hello!" I was mid-sentence. What was happening here? He accused me of speaking at him. He'd just interrupted me. But there was something about the conversation he'd misinterpreted or was unable to follow. He was getting very hot under the collar and increasingly aggressive. He wanted an argument. I softly replied, saying that I wasn't speaking at him, only to him, as that's what's necessary to have a conversation between two people. I said he was incredibly rude, but I was more than willing to pay the on-the-spot fine and asked him again to kindly tell me how much that was. Well, he wasn't expecting that, and he looked almost disappointed at how agreeable I was being. Instead, he puffed up his chest, realized he was onto a losing battle of composure and politeness, walked slowly over to the barrier and opened the gate with his keys. "You're lucky this time." Lucky? I'd just been publicly shouted at for offering to pay the penalty. This was a classic example of a man abusing his power. Was I supposed to be grateful for his kind act of generosity? Get fucked. I'd have preferred to go through the time-consuming process of paying the fine just so that he'd have a laborious task to undertake so he could take a break from being a twat. Some people might argue that he'd have behaved exactly the same way towards a man in my situation, but I don't believe it. When it comes to men asserting their power over women, I have experienced quite an array. Rosie, do you remember the time you repeatedly hit that man's car window, called him a twat, and completely lost your shit?
Yes. But we had pedestrian right of way and he aggressively beat at us to move so he could leave his parking space. We weren't even in the middle of a road.
I'm just pleased that you've grown as a person and can turn the other cheek. I'm also pleased that you scared him so much that he sped away in a panic because he didn't expect to anger such a turbulent beast. But sexism occurs in the most unlikely of places and in some extremely commonplace ones. Even my granddad used to ask if I was being looked after by a man, like I was weak, defenseless, and in need of saving. Of course, he meant no harm, but he'd ask so frequently that I'd feel obliged to put his mind at rest, so I developed the character of Hoyt. Hoyt was my fictitious Scandinavian love interest, a tree surgeon by day and an on-call veterinarian by night. He was the quintessence of heteronormative masculinity, and in years to come would become an integral character in our exposed tour. But before I can be accused of not educating my granddad on women's strength and self-reliance, one has to bear in mind the generation of his upbringing. Plus, I forgave him on account of his good intentions. My point here is that the idea of women being weak was so ingrained in society that even his love and care were spurred by sexist abstraction. This generational clash brought with it gender stereotypes that needed to be broken down and forgotten. Not dissimilar to Grandma's ice square, a hard dessert best eaten on the day.
What I'm beginning to understand is that most of us, unconsciously, have internal judgments that are a result of the society we have been raised in. I'm not even that old, but when I was in school, girls weren't allowed to play football and boys didn't do dance.
These rules that we are fed get subconsciously ingrained into our mindsets, and we have to work extremely hard to question why we think a certain way. I try really hard to consider why I feel the way I do before I make a judgment. I do see a change in society for the better. Gone are the days when women were inclined to say, "I'm not like other girls," in an attempt to set themselves apart from the stereotypes that were forced onto the generic label of girl. Now, women rally together in women's protests and marches. Women can proudly say that they are like other women. That doesn't mean that all females love makeup or the colour pink. It means that it doesn't matter whether they wear no makeup at all or colour themselves in glitter. It doesn't matter if women wear suits, play video games, have short hair, or don't subscribe to a particular gender norm. I'm convinced that the only way forward is to support each other. In a society of outraged culture, rather than coming at people with an immediately reactive response, it's great to look at a situation from all angles.
Rosie, wait! I haven't finished moaning about my silly women problems intensified by my hormones. So before we discuss how to overcome sexism, I have one more story that involves sexism from YouTube itself. This is a particularly juicy one, guaranteed to leave you woke. Last year, Rosie and I were put forward for a grant which would allow us to finance a creative project that we would pitch to a select board of members. We'd done extremely well even to have been put forward, and we thought it was the perfect opportunity to give the LGBTQ+ community even more mainstream exposure. We were asked what our plans for the future were, to which we responded, remaining entertaining, remaining visible, expanding our family, and being visibly representative of our community. The male staff member didn't seem particularly interested during our interview. Fine. Perhaps these were areas he felt didn't warrant financial investment. That was his prerogative, and I respected his opinion. Until, that is, he began to question our ability to be parents and simultaneously have a career on YouTube. And you think you could manage having a baby and doing YouTube? Have you thought about how tiring and difficult that might be? Having a baby and vlogging might be hard to juggle. What was he asking us? If we'd be able to manage a full-time job and have children? Like we hadn't considered what it meant to be working parents, or that because we were female, we wouldn't be able to cope? Would he ask the same question to a man? I couldn't believe what I was hearing from a guy in his late 20s. What was even more uncomfortable was that his female superior was also on the Skype call looking awkward as fuck, but remained silent, waiting for us to answer his moronic question. If you're asking whether the two of us believe we will cope with a child and a career, the answer's yes. We have considered that. How insulting. I knew we'd be unsuccessful with the grant, but I wasn't going to let that one slide. What bothers me the most is people assuming I'm playing the sexist card. Well, I have a trillion cards I could play, and sexism is just one of them. But just because I have them at my disposal doesn't mean I'm drawing them out without justification. It's very easy to shut someone down with the accusation that they're using prejudice as their pretext. But no matter how understanding, sensitive, and fair men can be, they will never experience what it's like to be discriminated against as a woman.
If there's one thing I've learned, it's that we can't just sit here and moan about our problems all day. We have to get up and make change happen, starting with ourselves. As much as I like to feel that I am woke and progressive, I'm self-aware enough to realise that I still have a long way to go. I'm problematic. We all are. We've all made mistakes. It's okay to admit that. After all, how can you change if you think you are already perfect? The world is constantly evolving, and it's easy to slip up, especially if you didn't realise you were doing something wrong. For instance, remember the online catchphrase of saying something was your spirit animal? I've since come to learn that this is a form of cultural appropriation of Indigenous peoples and their culture. Thankfully, society is progressing, and I am seeing a surge in political correctness and generally more awareness of other people. More awareness of disabilities, ethnicities, the treatment of minorities, and I'm noticing how many people on the internet are spreading these positive messages. I honestly can't convey how much I've learned from the internet, and I still continue to learn. But I've seen the downsides too. There's a Tumblr account called Your Fave is Problematic, dedicated to highlighting any slight wrongdoing of those in the public eye. I find this particularly unfair.
Everybody makes mistakes, but not everyone has to make them in public, and having your face rubbed in it is even worse. I've seen YouTubers trending over old tweets, and these witch hunts aren't always helpful. How would you feel if you got caught out being a massive dumbass and an angry mob brought their pitchforks and burned you?